districts, complete towns are destroyed. So it's going to take a lot of time to recover, actually. In that sense, I totally agree with Osman that, I mean, it's not really possible for the Turkish, I would say, government to respond to this crisis. In fact, in the first 3 days, state and governmental institutions, they even didn't exist. They weren't anywhere. It was just ordinary people, civil society organizations, political parties who mobilized to help people in need of urgent help, like food and shelter and those kinds of things. So the situation is bad. It's going to take a lot of time. And definitely there is a need for international support and solidarity. The government, unfortunately, declared emergency rule. So that was the first thing that they did. Rather than rescuing people from the rubble, they actually are now using emergency rule powers to somehow take control over even the humanitarian aid. It's a very bizarre situation. The government is obstructing, actually, the civil society as well as political parties to mobilize people for help. So when I hear very deeply what Osman was saying about the need for like international community to support Turkey and Syria, when you compare the amount of resources and money poured into, for example, the context of Ukraine, where we have a war actually over the last year because of the Russian invasion of unlawful invasion, of course, of Ukraine. There is a war there. Many people are dying. Probably not this many people that we have lost, I mean, in the earthquake. But when you see the kinds, probably like hundreds of billions of dollars, they were poured into that context, which is somehow militarizing the conflict, further militarizing the conflict. But when it is security and defense and those kinds of issues, there are always resources available. Money is always available. But when it comes to like a humanitarian situation like this, really, I mean, the numbers, the kind of funding that we are having from the international institutions is very, very limited. So more needs to be done. This is not a natural disaster in Turkey. It is a human-made disaster. Yes, earthquakes do happen. This is an earthquake zone. And since 1999, when we had the big earthquake in close to Istanbul, when we lost actually tens of thousands of people, since then a lot of scientists, experts, geologists, they have been warning our governments to prepare the country, particularly these towns and the people there, for the earthquake, but nothing was done. And because we don't have safe buildings, we have a lot of corruption and bribery, unfortunately. There is no good governmental inspection of the construction sector, which is the backbone of Turkish economy. So there is a whole corrupt economy behind this whole disaster. That is why we think of this disaster not as kind of a natural disaster. I mean, people don't die naturally. This is a massacre. And from the local governments to the central government to many other institutions who are responsible to actually build like safe houses for our people. Every citizen should have a right to a safe place to live. But we have seen like buildings only that were constructed like last year, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, despite the fact that we have on the paper strict regulations. But nobody is following the rules. And then an earthquake with a magnitude of 7.7 happens, and we have tens of thousands of people dead. In Japan, for example, an earthquake of 9.1 even couldn't be this kind of deadly. So that is why I think, I mean, I hope that people in Turkey, our governments will take this as a very serious warning, because Turkey is an earthquake country. I mean, these earthquakes are going to happen. But we never take the lesson, and we never prepare our towns and our people. And in that sense, we all actually have a lot of responsibility.
Bashir, could you elaborate on that, why you believe that Turkey, despite this devastating earthquake of 1999, did not take steps? I mean, some have suggested that in the last 20 years in which Erdogan has been the leader, first as prime minister and then as president, there was an increasing centralization of power around the presidency, and that this somehow has contributed to Turkey's lack of preparedness. Could you respond to that, whether you think that's true, and if so, how?
Yeah, I mean, you see, in Turkey, there is something that we call imar af in Turkish, which is, I think, it can be translated as zoning permission or zoning amnesty. So, which means that, I mean, people construct buildings not following the rules and, you know, all kinds of buildings which are not properly built, which do not have the permission from the government or the local authorities. These are just totally illegal settlements, okay? And then before every, almost every election, there is an amnesty for these people. So all these unlawfully constructed, like unsafe buildings, they are actually, there's a, like the government pardons them, and all of them, they become legal. This is a very, very major problem. It's not about the AKP government. Historically, over the last 50, 60 years, we have this practice. Every single government, to get some votes, they declare these amnesties, and they make legal, unlawfully built, unsafe, like houses, apartments. That is one thing. And the second thing is, the housing and these buildings, they are totally left to the mercy of a totally unregulated housing and construction market. So even the inspection of these buildings is being done by private companies. That is the most ridiculous thing. This is about the safety of your citizens. So you cannot really leave the inspection of those buildings to private companies. So in that sense, there should be some kind of public regulation of this building. So, for example, a construction company, actually, they can also have a building inspection company, and they can pay that company to inspect the buildings that they themselves are constructing. It is such a ridiculous situation. So the local governments and the central government, they need to take responsibility and make sure that the houses that are being built are built properly based on the rules, and punish those who do not follow the rules. Honestly, we think this is a massacre, and there are perpetrators. Now the government is arresting a couple of contractors, some business people, but, I mean, that is scapegoating, actually. And they are also attacking some poor Syrian refugees, accusing them of, like, you know, stealing stuff from the rubble. So now we have the immigrants to attack, right? The Syrian poor refugees, immigrants to attack. And then we have a couple of contractors, some business people who built those buildings. Yes, they do have some responsibility, but the majority of the responsibility falls on the shoulders of the government and the local governments who are authorized, who are responsible to make sure that these buildings are built properly as safe was. That is not happening. And there is corruption, there is bribery. And I was in Marash district, actually. I was visiting this family, and they told me, actually, that in this earthquake zone in Pazarcık district of Marash, you can only build a 5-story building, but their building was 10-story. And I asked them, I said, how this happened? They said, we just saw the mayor and, you know, we could get permission. Can you imagine that? I mean, it's incredible. I mean, like, and everybody knows this, actually. The society knows this. I mean, the government, local government, everybody is a part of this. So that is why I think this is a collectively carried out massacre, mass murder, really. I mean, and there are perpetrators of this, and these are not just some, you know, contractors. I mean, the government should be kept responsible.
Bashir Özsoy, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Deputy Chair of the People's Democratic Party, member of the Turkish Parliament, representing Diyarbakir in southern Turkey, the largest Kurdish majority city in Turkey, where we have been helping with disaster relief, just came from a funeral. Next up, we look at the spiraling global economic crisis from Pakistan to Sri Lanka to Lebanon, where protesters today attacked 6 banks, setting some of them them on fire. Back in 30 seconds. By Lina Chamamian. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. As debates continue in Washington over raising the debt ceiling and combating inflation, we take a global look at the growing international economic crisis as soaring inflation and devalued currencies leave nations across the globe confronting a catastrophic debt crisis. Lebanon's facing what the World Bank has described as, quote, among the most severe crises globally since the mid-19th century. Earlier today, Lebanese protesters attacked at least six banks, setting some on fire as the Lebanese pound hit a new record low. Since 2019, the pound's lost 98% of its value. Protesters accused the Lebanese government and banks of failing to help the people.
What are you Lebanese people waiting for to go down and take your rights from this mafia of thieves and criminals that is ruling? Where are the human rights? There is no electricity, no water, nothing at all in this country. Don't they feel us while sitting in their palaces? They don't feel the people. They see us as sheep. We won't stay silent about our life's worth.
In addition to Lebanon, numerous other countries are facing similar crises. An Iraq protest recently broke out in Baghdad over the plummeting value of Iraq's currency, the dinar. In Egypt, the value of the Egyptian pound has shrunk in half over the past year while prices have soared. In Sri Lanka, authorities have just raised the price of electricity by 66% in an effort to get a bailout from the International Monetary Fund. Last year, Sri Lanka defaulted on its debt for the first time in its history. Pakistan is also facing its worst economic crisis, leading to gas shortages, power outages, rampant price increases. Meanwhile, in Argentina, inflation's hit nearly 100%. To look more at this global growing economic crisis, we're joined by Jomo Kwame Sundaram. He is a Malaysian economist at the Khazanah Research Institute in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. He was an economics professor and then UN Assistant Secretary General for Economic Development. In 2007, he received the Wassily Lantief Prize for advancing the frontiers of economic thought. Professor Jomo Kwame Sundaram, thank you so much for being with us. Can you just comment on what is confronting, in the United States, we focus on inflation here, but the global catastrophe of inflation and what it means.
Thank you very much for having me, Amy. The world situation is very, very serious, not because we have a conspiracy to worsen the situation, but we have a confluence of events. Two developments in particular threaten the world economy in very, very deep ways. Firstly, of course, we know that the US Fed has raised interest rates over the last year, and this has had catastrophic consequences for many developing countries. We have seen capital leaving most developing countries, most countries in the global south, and this has resulted in their currencies depreciating and the US dollar appreciating. That often raises the cost of their imports, which are often necessary for their subsistence. The other major development, which has been the other related development, of course, has been that the cost of debt has gone up tremendously, and the cost of debt going up basically puts many economies into very serious difficulties because they are no longer able to service their debts, especially given the currencies are declining in value. Of course, some commodity prices have gone up, but many other commodity prices have not gone up. And this worsens the situation in very deep ways. So we have, of course, we have as a consequence a very, very deep threats of recession in many of these economies. And then at the same time, we have the stepping up of warfare, warfare not only by military means, which of course are very important, and divert precious resources away from needed purposes, dealing with climate change and so on and so forth, and instead divert them for military purposes. Germany, for example, has tripled its military spending within the last year. And we, as a consequence of this, what we see now is that economic sanctions have basically become the norm. When economic sanctions were taken against countries like North Korea or Cuba and so on, these were relatively small economies which had very few ramifications for the rest of the world. But now we have a situation where economic sanctions have resulted in the increase in prices of fuel, increases in prices of food, and increase of prices of fertilizer. All this will have very, very serious implications for the availability of affordable food, particularly for poorer people in the world all over the place. And this combination of war, include especially by increasingly economic means, is going to exacerbate the situation. One should also add that the another war has started on a completely different front, and that is the war against China. The war against China began arguably about almost a decade ago with the pivot to Asia from Washington. But this has increasingly meant that many of the so-called supply chains, the global, the value chains and so on and so forth, have been seriously disrupted. And this was adversely affects all other countries as well, because, you know, what is supposedly produced in China is not produced in China alone. It's produced by all other, by many other countries which are part of the value chains in which China may be dominant. So we have a situation where strategic and military considerations are resulting in more and more economic warfare. The polite term in Washington, I believe, is economic statecraft, and this, of course, threatens the world in very profound ways. If we look back at, sorry.
I was just going to ask if you could elaborate on China in particular, which is now the largest government creditor to a number of countries in the global south, but also the principal trading partner of many countries in the global south, and not just the global south. So if you could talk about the significance, the centrality of China in this crisis.
Yes, much of the production from China and from China going to the rest of the world is actually dependent on inputs from other parts of the world, especially from the global south. So, for example, we in Southeast Asia produce a great deal. China is the number one trading partner, and for some countries, the number one investor as well. The same is increasingly true in many sub-Saharan African countries, and much of the growth in sub-Saharan Africa in the first decade of this century was largely due to the increase of demand from China and India and other so-called new markets. And in even in Latin America, we find that the principal trading partner for many countries, and sometimes even the principal investor, happens to be China. So the implications of sanctions against China are not directly affecting China as much as they are also affecting other countries in the global south. So the fact that they are borrowing, that many of these countries are borrowing from China, is of course a matter of serious concern for these countries. Most countries in the global south do not want to take part on either side of the Cold War, which is emerging. They would prefer to be non-aligned. And so there's a new role for what was once called non-alignment in the first Cold War. But this new non-alignment, of course, is very different because we are basically talking about very similar economies which are run, dominated by what might be termed capitalist enterprises. some perhaps more state capitalists, some less state capitalists, and so on and so forth. So this relationship with China is so central for many countries in the global south that any blow intended against China often adversely affects many other countries, sometimes even much more than they affect China.
Could you explain, Joma, what the impact is of having many more creditors than in the past? I mean, not just China, the IMF, et cetera, but others involved as well. What are the effects of that on attempts to restructure this debt?
When the U.S. Fed raised interest rates in the early 1980s, this basically shocked the world economy, and the world economy threatened to come to a grinding halt. President Reagan at that time forced a reversal of the Fed's policies, and the U.S. economy picked up. But as we all know now, Latin America lost at least a decade. Some people would argue more than a decade, and much of sub-Saharan Africa lost arguably two decades. Some even suggest a quarter of a century as a consequence of the raising of interest rates and also the kinds of policies which were imposed from the Washington-based so-called Bretton Woods institutions, such as the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. The consequence of that was to bring many of these economies to a grinding halt. Much of this was justified as supposedly necessary to get these economies off to a fresh start. But that fresh start never really came. As we now know, with the benefit of hindsight, when economies began to pick up, they began to pick up precisely for other reasons, including the external demand from places like China and India, which I referred to earlier.
And finally, the human effects of this around the world. We started this conversation by talking about Lebanese protesters burning the banks, the massive inflation in Egypt, and what's happening in Pakistan.
Well, what's happened in Lebanon, of course, was preceded by what happened months ago in Sri Lanka and similar episodes which have happened elsewhere. But the ability to protest presumes a certain degree of of means to do so. In many situations, people are suffering often in silence, trying to make ends meet. Usually, invariably, when governments are forced to cut spending, they cut health spending, they cut social spending, they cut education spending, they cut other kinds of social provisioning, for example, for girl children and so on and so forth. And very importantly, they cut spending for example, trying to adapt to global warming, global heating, if you will. And most countries in the global south are, of course, in the tropical or subtropical zone where the impact of global heating is worse. So we have a situation where you have a perfect storm. I'm not suggesting there's the deliberate conspiracy between the U.S. Fed and the Defense Department and NATO and the European Union and so on and so forth. But the effect is tantamount to the effects of a seeming conspiracy. So many countries in the global south are looking elsewhere. They're looking at alternatives. They're trying to survive in this situation. They see a looming crisis ahead of them, and they don't know how to avoid it. It's like being on the Titanic. You see the iceberg, but you don't know what to do about it.
Professor Joma Kwame Sundaram, we're going to ask you to stay with us for right after the show. We want to do part two of this conversation, leading Malaysian economists speaking to us from Kuala Lumpur. When we come back, we go to East Palestine, Ohio. Stay with us.
Destroy the empire! Thank you.
Destroy the Empire by Pachiman. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Hundreds of residents in East Palestine, Ohio, packed into their first town hall meeting Wednesday night after a bomb train carrying hazardous materials derailed there last week, and a so-called controlled burn sent a mushroom cloud of toxic chemicals blended with fire and smoke into the air. The EPA said chemicals were released, quote, to air, surface soils, and surface waters. Norfolk Southern backed out of the town hall meeting. EPA Chief Michael Regan's visiting East Palestine today as residents want the incident to be declared a federal emergency. Emily Wright is with us again with River Valley Organizing for an update from Columbiana County, Ohio, a few miles from the derailment and explosion at East Palestine. We spoke to you earlier this week. Emily, can you talk about what happened last night? Norfolk Southern did not come to address the people. What's happening right now? People are terrified as they see thousands of fish, of frogs dead, and yet the authorities are saying the water, the air is safe.
We've had, you know, thank you so much. I just wanted to thank your program for the coverage that you've done. We really appreciate it. Yeah, things have been rapidly evolving over the last 48 hours. As you know, Norfolk Southern put out a statement. They were not coming to the meeting. They cited their employees' safety. They said they made to our local news station a statement that said that they were concerned that residents would basically cause physical harm to their employees, and so they weren't going to come. I have not seen or heard one threat physically of violence or anything against Norfolk Southern. The only thing I've heard is that people want to know what's going on. People were angry as the forum kept changing. First, it was a town hall where elected officials were going to be there. You know, even from the state, you know, in federal representation, that questions were going to be answered over, you know, a couple hour period. That changed to being like an open house with tables where people could come ask questions if they wanted. And honestly, without Norfolk Southern being there, a lot of people's questions were answered. We found out over the last 48 hours that there are several cities south of the site that are experiencing chemicals in their water, two of which the butyl, I'm going to pronounce it wrong, but one of the chemicals in particular was in Steubenville, Ohio's water. They are an hour south, like over 60 miles south of East Palestine. Toronto, Ohio, the same, south of them. In Moundsville, West Virginia, which is in the panhandle, they've had pictures of the river turning turquoise from the chemicals. So the fallout is really beginning to happen. The instructions were very vague from each city. They basically said they think the levels are low, and they think the water's safe, that they think. People closer, like around where I am and in East Palestine, have been told to drink bottled water. I fortunately work with a lot of people that have dealt with this, and the first thing they told me to do was buy bottled water when this happened, before even the controlled release. So residents are understandably angry, upset. Norfolk Southern just came out this morning on our local news program. I apologize. And an employee was interviewed, and we found out that the train that derailed in East Palestine was broke down in Madison, Illinois on February 1st. And they believed the train was broke down because the contents were too heavy that it was carrying. And Norfolk Southern apparently was warned by employees that that train was too heavy and that something like this could happen. So they were having issues with the train anyway. We know the EPA director is coming down today to the site because he wants to encourage that everything's going status quo. But again, like we've said time and time again for almost 2 weeks, we were told only about air, that it was safe. Water, soil, and surface was basically told it was, you know, surface wasn't being done, water and soil was, but it's ongoing.
Emily, we have 20 seconds, your final comment.
Yeah, people were let back in their homes. So we really need a federal emergency to be declared. We need Our Governor DeWine, we absolutely need him to, when he talks to President Biden's administration today or tomorrow, to tell them that we need FEMA in here. There are short-term and long-term effects that will be some of the gravest that this nation has ever seen in a train derailment.
Well, Emily Wright, we're going to continue to follow this story. Development Director for River Valley Organizing in Ohio, speaking to us from Portsmouth, Ohio, just next to East Palestine, where the train derailment took place. The train was 2 miles long with toxic chemicals. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, SFU's community radio station, broadcasting live from Burnaby, B.C.